because there's this like, I want to get it right, you know, thing. How do we get it right for 40 people at the same time? But the bigger part, the much bigger part, is the joy. A lot of joy in this. And I wouldn't give it up for any amount of fear. I would not give up this joy. And it kind of, you know, it leads perfectly into what I'm going to talk about tonight. Today, it's not tonight. We usually do Dharma talks at night, so I keep like thinking it's nighttime. It's daytime. Is how this path, how this, these four noble truths that we've been talking about, the fourth being the Eightfold Path, ultimately lead us to the cessation of suffering, not suffering any longer. And that's a really fun thing to teach. You know, sometimes we have to knock ourselves over the head a bajillion times to get it. Which is why we teach the same, you know, a lot of students will say, well, God, I don't want to go anymore because they teach the same thing. You know, it's like, well, yeah, because do you really have it? Do you really have it? Like, oh, I've heard the Four Noble Truths. Have you really? Like, maybe you've heard it, but do you know it? Do you live it? Do you feel it? Are you it? It's a really different thing from having heard it before. And then part of the joy is that I get to share this practice with others. You know, it's not singular. It's not only me. And I'm thinking about the fact that we're here on a Friday night, you know, like, it's kind of awesome. there's other things going on tonight. And I love that we're here together doing this. And I always thought it was really interesting. After the Buddha reached his enlightenment, so it says in the suttas, he didn't want to teach. He was really hesitant to teach. And I want to read a little bit of the sutta because I think it's so beautiful. What it says, and my glasses made me loud. That's kind of interesting, right? Like eyesight goes up here. You know how our senses change when, okay, never mind. Weird. I considered this Dhamma that I have attained is profound. This is the Buddha speaking. He's sharing this teaching with some of his, with the five students he first started teaching to after his enlightenment. I considered this Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, right? Like, unattainable by mere reasoning. Subtle, to be experienced by the wise. But this generation delights in worldliness, takes delight in worldliness, rejoices in worldliness. I'm like, that generation, like, check us out now, if only you could see. It is hard for such a generation to see this truth, namely, specific conditionality, dependent origination. And it is hard to see this truth, namely, the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. You know, so he was really feeling at that time, and I'm going to read a little more because I like this part better, which is why we're sitting here. It's because he changed his mind. But really felt like what he had acquired wasn't accessible or wouldn't be accessible to the world that he was living in, to his generation. And then Brahma Sahampati at the time was reading his mind and hearing him in his mind say that I am not going to teach, and decided to show up to him in the flesh. And says, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma. Let the Sublime One teach the Dhamma. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are wasting through not hearing the Dhamma. there will be those who will understand the Dhamma. So that's you guys. That's us. Like, we're the beings with little dust in our eyes. The fact that we are here, that we're showing up, that we actually like this shit, you know, like this, like maybe, I mean, maybe we don't always like it, but like we're still here. You have the option to leave. Did you know that? Whoops, maybe I wasn't supposed to tell you that. The gate opens. Like you drive across the thing and the gate opens. It's kind of cool. In Magadha, there have appeared till now impure teachings devised by those still stained. Open the doors to the deathless. Let them hear the Dhamma that the saintless one has found. Sorry, the stainless one has found. Just as one who stands on a mountain peak can see below the people all around, so, O wise one, all-seeing sage, ascend the palace of the Dhamma. Let the sorrowless one survey this human breed, engulfed in sorrow, overcome by birth and old age. Arise, victorious hero, caravan leader, debtless one, and wander in the world. Let the blessed one teach the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand. So that was Brahma Sahampati convincing the Buddha to teach. Sometimes I feel like those are my teachers. It's like, I don't want to teach, but you have to teach. And, you know, I love that. Like, imagine had that not happened. So the ones with little dust in their eyes. And we forget, and we forget, and we forget. And so what I want to talk about tonight is this path. You know, it's like, in case they forget, I'm going to make it really clear. I'm going to make it really easy. And they'll still forget, but I'm going to make it really easy. And at his time, he was, you know, I don't know if this is anywhere in the suttas, but I've heard this said that he was referred to like as a physician, right? So he saw the illness, so the illness being suffering. He saw the cause being craving. And then the prognosis, right? Like, is it possible to cure? Is this a curable disease? Is it an uncurable disease? And he said, yes, it's totally curable. And I have the cure. And the cure, the prescription, is this noble eightfold path. So that's what I want to talk about. And this path, and are a lot of you familiar? I'm familiar with the path. Some of you, yes. Some not so much. Well, there's 8 path factors. And anytime we see a list, we assume, or I assume that it's laid out linearly, right? So 1 leads to 2, 2 leads to 3, 3 leads to 4. And in some ways, we can look at the path like that. But in other ways, it's often depicted, and this is how I like to look at it, it's depicted as a wheel. And actually, over the awning, as you enter here, they have the Dharma wheel. I have it tattooed on my inner arm, so I don't forget. I noticed it's here on the podium. So this is a really significant mark in Buddhism, a very significant depiction of what we're doing, and also a reminder. Like, I have to tattoo things on my body so I don't forget. Like, I have the equanimity phrase here, I have the, you know, the Dharma wheel here. It's my walking altar. It's my way of remembering my path. So it's depicted as a wheel, and why I like that better than the linear sense is wheels around, we know that. But the way a wheel works is when any spoke on the wheel is broken, there's kind of a ka-thump, a ka-thump. It doesn't roll smoothly. And that's okay. The wheel might still roll, but it's not as smooth. And so in this wheel, there are 8 spokes. Sorry, it's rude. There are 8 spokes, just like the path factors. And they all kind of play upon each other. They all feed each other. They all work because another one is being worked upon as well. And like I said, I'm going to get into these, but I just want to give you the big picture of it. There's also another description that I really like, which is the three strands of a braid. Because the Eightfold Path is broken up into three parts, which is Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. So Sila being our ethical practice, or the way that we are in the world, our actions. Samadhi being our, what we're doing here, our meditation practice, our concentration practice, and the effort that it takes to be, to do it. And then the Panya is the wisdom practice. And I'll get into each of those individually. But I really like that idea too, the three strands of a braid. If anyone's ever tried to braid their hair, I notice you braid your hair. If anyone's ever tried to braid, you can't do it with two. You can't do it. Well, you can do it with four, but it's different. But they work. They intertwine. They weave into each other. And so I want to ask you, so I've laid out Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. Sila, action, the way we are in the world. Samadhi, our meditation, concentration practice. Panya, our wisdom practice. I'm curious, and this is just a reflection, how each of you came to the path. You know, because a lot of us come to the path, a lot of us, not all of us, through suffering. Like we've suffered somehow, and we're trying to find some answer, some relief, some different way of being in the world, right? So we come. But there's many different ways that we come. Some people will go and meditate. You know, they'll go and they'll sit and they'll reflect and they'll find a center or some way to find to meditate. Other people, it might be from picking up a book. You know, I remember for me, it was like picking up Charlotte Joko Beck's book. That was the first thing I did. I think I was, you know, 20 years old and I picked up her book, and it was like there were these wisdom teachings that made sense to me that sort of sunk in, and like, oh yeah, if I do this, then this happens. If I don't do that, then that doesn't happen. Wow, that's amazing. You know, these really simple yet profound teachings. Some of us come that way. Some of us come through maybe how our actions in the world, maybe through activism or through relationship, you know, working on relational practices. Or maybe through sobriety, you know, some way that life wasn't working. So we had to act in a different way. We had to take different actions. So there's lots of different ways that we come to the path. And I'm curious, like I said, just take a second. If it takes closing eyes, fine. If not, you know, some of you might know right away. What was that first moment? You know, I know some of you in this room are Buddhist born, so it was maybe family. But what was that moment that brought you to the path? And that's what I kind of like about this teaching of Sila, Samadhi, Panya, is it wasn't just, I didn't just enter through right view, which is the first path factor. I didn't just enter through meditation practice. There are multiple ways to sort of hop on the Ferris wheel, you know? It stops and picks people up, and then it stops again and picks someone else up, and it stops again. And we all get to get on in different ways of, you know, how we need to, what we choose to. And sometimes the wheel might be a little fatter on one side. You know, maybe we're more active in one area. Maybe we have more time to sit retreats. You know, I know many of you get to have the beautiful luxury of going on 3-month retreats and all those things, which is so nice. And then others, like I said, might do it through the way they live in the world. You know, so this Sila, Samadhi, Panya, this action, practice, wisdom, always working together, the three strands of the braid. The wheel, working together. So I'm going to walk through them. I mean, these are lists upon lists, which are interesting. And then also yogi mind can also be kind of like, you don't need to remember any of this. Like, this isn't a test. None of it needs to, you know, we don't need to remember it. Just listen and see what sinks in. See what you hear. See what makes sense. See what feels right. See what resonates. So the first one is right view. And each of these could be a talk unto themselves. Each of these could be a month unto themselves. So I'm going to just briefly go over them. But right view, or sometimes called right understanding, the first path factor, is really basically brushstrokes, seeing things as they really are. Seeing things as they really are, which is what we're working on here. And it's broken down into karma. So if we're looking at karma as cause and effect, you know, have you noticed on this retreat? A lot of you have. You know, one of the things that comes up a lot is sleep, right? We notice that when we don't get enough sleep, we're tired the next day. Like, wow, you know, big wow. But it's cause and effect. That's what it is. We notice if we eat too much, we feel full. When we don't eat enough, we feel hungry. You know, very simple things get to be revealed on this retreat. And karma can become a very easy thing to connect to. It doesn't have to be the big karma of next lives or, you know, I was a bad person when I was 15, so what's going to happen when I'm 45? You know, it can be like moment-to-moment awareness. Again, 1 + 2 = 3. Very interesting to watch. We get to see that when we slow the mind down. The other one is something called dependent origination. And this is really that thing where, I said I wasn't going to get too into these. It's so hard to stop myself because, like I said, I love talking about it. But, you know, just when an object comes into our awareness, do we immediately see ourselves liking it or disliking it? Here's an object. Here's the cookie. Pleasant. Lean in more. Or here's the spider crawling on the wall, unpleasant. Lean back. Dependent origination. And then what comes after that, which I won't get into that. But just basically, and then the three marks of existence. Dukkha, anicca, anatta. Suffering, impermanence, and this clinging or attachment to a fixed and permanent self. These are all sort of things that you guys have probably come into contact with. And when I say them as a list, they sound like they're over there. But as you've been watching the mind on this retreat, a few of you pointed to really seeing, oh, sometimes I feel good, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I'm suffering, sometimes I'm not. Impermanence. The Four Noble Truths is also in this list of right view. So it's interesting how in the first path factor, it goes back to naming the exact thing that it's the fourth truth of, right? So it's all very circular. It all feeds off of each other. So right view, seeing things as they really are, big picture, right? And then right intention. And the word right, wise, purifying, helpful. Doesn't have to be right in terms of right and wrong. I'm just using that term because that's how it's often used. So that's what's going to come out of my mouth. Right intention points a lot to renunciation. And not renunciation in the terms of deprivation. I'm going to take it away from you. But I love being in interviews because I get to really see what's going on in the room. It's like renunciation of the things that grab our mind that we can't let go of. Can we renounce those things? How attached are we to that first the view? How much judgment do we have about other people here? Judgment, self-judgment towards ourself. So the intention to untangle a little, let the mind unweave from this grasping, these ideas that we have, which is why these Brahmavihara practices are so perfect to weave in, you know, like the forgiveness of this self-recrimination that we've held on to for so long. Like, what are our views? What are we holding on to so tightly? And can we renounce them? And then another part of wise intention is goodwill. Sharing, spreading this metta that we've been doing, this metta for ourselves, for others. This is cultivating this path that we're on, this prescription is helping us to see how can we do this liberating thing? Okay, well, goodwill is one of them. Kindness towards others, kindness towards ourselves. And then the next one in right intention is harmlessness. I love when I watch people walk around the property, or when we're on retreat especially, and we notice like the tiniest of little creatures on the ground, and we'll either usher them onto the dirt or walk around them. And, you know, it's like that's really deeply paying attention to harmlessness and this way of kindness and goodwill. It's really beautiful. I was at East Bay Meditation Center a couple weeks ago, and they have this really beautiful, their guidelines of the center. It's as if people don't know about it and they live in the Bay Area, I highly recommend it. It's like no other center that I've really visited because of its diversity. They're really committed to diversity, every kind of diversity. But one of the things that I love that they have up on their wall, these guidelines, they talk about, in terms of harmlessness, they talk about the difference between intention and impact. Right. So often, it confused me a little bit because oftentimes in Buddhism, we talk about intention. Right. Well, I didn't mean to hurt you. Like, I'm sorry that hurt you when I said that. I didn't mean it. Right. And somehow that lets us off the hook. It's not what I meant. But what I liked about this was the follow through of our words. Right. The follow through is like, are we really paying attention to impact? Is our intention, what really is our intention behind what we just said? Is it to get something off of our chest? Or are we really paying attention to the impact, the future impact of what we just did or what we just said? It's kind of an interesting reflection, and that actually moves us into right speech, you know, because there's the intention part of not causing harm and intention and impact. And then we move into right speech, which I'm not going to get into too much. I'll make this the broader package of sila, so the second part of the path, or the third or the first or whatever package you want to put it in. Sila, which is the action, ethical. Sometimes the word ethical feels really judgmental. So it's just, how can we, one of the phrases I really like is the bliss of blamelessness. I really love that. How am I walking on this earth in a way where I can wake up in the morning and not have to kind of review what I did yesterday? Who did I say what to? Did I cuss somebody out? Did I hurt someone's feelings? You know, like, it used to be like, who did I wake up next to? What did I drink yesterday? Like, you know, like all of those things. Now, phew, that's not there anymore. So it's so nice to get to wake up in the morning feeling blameless, or that we've done everything possible to feel that way. When I watch I have a couple dogs, and when I watch them, you know, they just lift their leg wherever they want. And it's sort of like, sometimes I think of unskillful people like that. You know, they just lift their leg wherever they want. It's not okay. It's totally not okay. I don't as much anymore, but I used to work in prisons a lot. And there was this one guy, and he would talk about the 3 to 5 seconds that changed his life. The 3 to 5 seconds where he had an emotion, rage, that created an intention, cause harm, that led to an action that took somebody's life. He said it took 3 to 5 seconds, and it changed his life forever. And that's why I like how this path works. I'm not happy for that guy. But when we then move into what's next is this mindfulness package, this samadhi, an effort package. The reason he had brought this up is he was in a mindfulness class. And he was saying, had I known then what I know now, that I can have that arise, and not have to have it show up as an action, he would be somewhere else right now. And so this path then leads us into the piece of the samadhi piece, as we call it, sila samadhi panya, which consists of effort and mindfulness and concentration. And effort, just really paying attention to what we're cultivating in the mind. What are we paying attention to? Where are we putting our effort? There's that great Chumash story. That's just a fable story where, you know, a young boy is talking to his grandfather and he's asking him, you know, well, there's this, I have this wolf and there's this wolf, right? And this wolf is really full of anger and hatred and spite and jealousy and, you know, all these things. And then this one is really full of joy and happiness. I'll use the metta phrases. You know, it's full of metta and compassion and equanimity and joy. And he asked the grandfather, well, which one wins? Like, there's these two wolves in battle. Which one wins? And the grandfather just says, the one you feed. Right? So for feeding this, for efforting towards really digging into what's not working and how it's not right? Or are we really digging into releasing ourselves from this bondage? What we pay attention to is what grows. Anybody that's a germinator or a gardener, you know, anytime we're growing something, when we feed it, it grows. My son is 6'4". I can tell you that for sure. I've been feeding him. He grew. So yeah, so just really paying attention to what we're feeding, or if we're allowing ourselves to get caught in the hindrances, we're allowing ourselves to get caught in greed and aversion and kind of spinning around in the drain with it. And so effort is really pointing to paying attention to that. Which way are we leaning? What are we feeding? And then mindfulness. You guys have been doing this so well. You know, being available for what's happening right now. Right now. And then right now. And then right now. And then there's this way that as you guys have been doing it, you know, this, when we slow things down, we have the opportunity to sort of unravel the parts, to unravel the way things might be attached to. We can see if something's attached to a past thought, or if it's attached to a hope, or if something's attached to a physical sensation, or if it's attached to a memory. You know, there are these ways that suddenly we can see a lot more clearly when we're watching, when we're paying attention. And there's something about it that can't have striving involved. There's sort of like a goallessness to it. Real mindfulness, you know, when we're really, really paying attention. The second we find ourselves leaning towards greed or aversion, we're instantly out of mindfulness, because there's a wanting happening. When there's a wanting happening, we're not really paying attention to direct experience in the same way. Sayadaw Utejaniya says, many yogis have this idea that their meditation begins when the bell rings. He rings the bell when they start the meditation. That's not so. The bell is there only to remind you. The right time to practice is from the time you wake up in the morning to the time you go to bed at night. When you wake up in the morning, check yourself. Is the mind clear? Does it feel refreshed? Is it sleepy? Is that difficult to know? You are practicing to know the mind and the body as it is, right? So it actually doesn't matter what it is. It's the quality of knowing that we're looking at. The second it moves into judgment of that knowing is when we slightly move out of mindlessness, mindfulness. And there are some teachers I hear, and I'd be curious, I'll ask Gil later his opinion on this, but that mindfulness as a pure state doesn't have any greed or aversion in it. And I was really confused about that. I remember my first few retreats, I would say to my teacher, well, you read these stories about people that have done really violent acts or whatever that say that they were really present, that they're really, sometimes when we're doing certain things, we feel really alive. But is that mindfulness just because we're present? And from what I'm learning, the state of mindfulness doesn't have those other things attached to them. His eyes are closed. And then the last one, which is concentration, or known as samadhi, which is a state of real collectedness of the mind. It's a state when a lot of people think it's a very, want to think that it's this rigid state of stay with the breath, then I'm concentrated. But as probably some of you have found, those moments of the most concentration is when you've been relaxed, right? There's a stillness, there's a calm, there's a quietness, there's a relaxation, but yet there's still just a collectedness of the mind. Not like mindfulness where it goes from place to place and can know where it's going. It's a state that's much more gathered, much more collected. And the suttas oftentimes refer to the jhanas, talking about concentration. And there's some debate around the jhanas, even in the suttas. There's a lot of debate between different schools, different teachers about, do you have to be in a jhana to awaken? And mostly in the Thai forest tradition or certain traditions that we follow, that's not necessarily true, that awakening can happen through mindfulness, through other ways of practicing the Eightfold Path. So there's the jhana debate, and everybody has their own way and can see for themselves, of course, always. But I just wanted to lay that out there, that it doesn't have to be this really intensified experience to really actually see the nature of reality, to see impermanence, to see dependent origination, to see karma. Again, leading us back, going through the wheel over and over, how they overlap, how they intertwine. And so Bhikkhu Bodhi has this quote that kind of blends it all together for me. I really like this. The mind's intentional function forms the crucial link connecting our cognitive perspective with our modes of active engagement in the world. On the one side, actions always point back to the thoughts from which they spring. Right? Thought is the forerunner of action, directing body and speech, stirring them into activity, using them as its instruments for expressing its aims and ideals. These aims and ideals, our intentions, in turn, point back a further step to the prevailing views. When wrong views prevail, the outcome is wrong intention, giving rise to unwholesome actions. So it seems really simple, right? It seems really basic. If I'm unmindful, my intentions are maybe leaning me in the wrong direction, and therefore my actions will follow those intentions. I'm paying attention. I mean, so many times, you know, it's like, how many times do we just have to stop ourselves? Sometimes it's really just about knowing and stopping. And then wisdom gets to be there when we have real clarity, because there's mindfulness present, because our mind is still. When there's clarity, there's wisdom. And then right action can come out of that wisdom versus out of habit or opinion or judgment or criticism or whatever, you know, we're used to making action come out of. We have a much clearer view. And sometimes it's just telling us to stop. Not right now. And so part of what my excitement was in teaching about this isn't just because I've, you know, when I sit up here sometimes, I look at just words on a page and it actually confuses me a lot. Like my mind gets muddled and it doesn't make sense. And then suddenly I start talking and remembering and feeling why I'm up here and why I'm doing this. And it's because this path has been everything for me. This path saved my life. You know, and I don't even mean in like really drastic ways. I'm not talking about, you know, although I did get myself in trouble, but it saved my mind. It saved my heart, you know, even in the smallest of ways. It actually, like, I wake up happy every day. And so that's the only reason I sit up here, because I actually don't like it very much. It causes me a lot of anxiety. But the path has brought me so much joy. And it wasn't that I was seeking joy, right? There's this way that there's kind of like we can create more craving in looking for outcomes. Like, I want to go find happiness. And maybe that's a way to go get to the path. But then even if that's the goal, like, you still have to do the work, unfortunately. You know, you still have to get ugly and dirty. You don't get to just get happy. You have to excavate. And then cultivate. And sometimes the excavating and the cultivating can happen at the same time. But there's grief and there's sorrow and there's things that we dig into. But the good news, like the really good news, is that there's more joy than not. And a lot of the joy comes from like the simplest of things. You know, like I was talking about saving the life of a bug. That feels so good, you know? So I want to just mention a few of the types of joy as I've been digging in through the suttas as I do. You know, I was looking at this word joy in the indexes and kind of going through all of my different books. And what is this joy pointed to? And so I just want to share some of those ways. And the first way, you know, is just what I've been talking about, is following that path that just, when we make wiser choices, we get to be happier. And one of the interesting things that I found in multiple interviews today, multiple, so I'm not talking about any one of the however many of you I saw today, was a lot of you are getting to this place that feels a little bit like nothing's happening, right? And when I look at that and when I think about that, it's really sort of like, oh, you mean no drama's happening? You know, nothing bad's happening? You know, so then that can feel like we get so used to being in these heightened states of arousal and, you know, the cortisol and the nervous system and being like in like being constantly tormented out in the world, that when we're actually kind of in a state of like, it's actually like equanimity, we don't even know how to act. Like, we think there's something wrong. And it's so interesting. And so it's like, enjoy it. Like, really feel into the pleasure of there not being anything wrong. Wow, it's so funny that we think there's something wrong with there not being anything wrong. So, yeah, so one of them that I, you know, is just like the joy of the Dharma or spiritual joy that's not based on our ego, that's not based on getting something, that's not based on an object. It's not based on acquisition, you know? It's just really simple peace. Like, that's joy. We somehow want to compare our joys to another, you know, like, oh, that person's smiling, they look happier than me, or I'm noticing people crying, so they must be getting to something. Or, you know, there's this way that we, even in like the retreat center, you know, we compare ourselves, or they walk slower than me, like they get it, or their back is straighter, you know. So like we do this comparing thing, and in the comparing, like that's a hindrance to joy. It doesn't allow us to really see like the value in just the teeniest things that are actually really okay right now, that are pretty great right now. Because I'm not suffering until I look at somebody else, and then then suddenly I'm suffering. But you know, there's so many beautiful things. I've retreated a lot out in the desert, and I remember just, you know, when I would first get to the desert, it just looked dry and cactusy and sharp. You know, and by the time I left, the ground was breathing and I could see every ant, and, you know, each cactus had a flower, and it's just, you know, everything came alive because I wasn't so blocked anymore. And so, but that's so simple. It's not a big deal, like to see ants crawling. It's not a big deal. But wow, it is. It's alive. It's beautiful. So really seeing and allowing yourself, like that's a big thing. Allow yourself to see the beauty. Like what color lenses do you have on right now? You know, can you allow yourself to put on the specs that let you see beauty? Take it in. Let it be okay to enjoy. And then mudita is another type of joy. And mudita is actually the Brahmavihara. And we've been teaching the Brahmaviharas. Mudita is typically described as sympathetic joy. So joy for another, taking joy or delight in the joy of another. So that comparing mind that I was talking about, that doesn't allow us to take joy in another. You know, if someone shares something really great with you, and in your mind you're going, why not me? Like, why did it happen to them? They don't actually deserve it. I deserve it. You know, then we can't really have joy for another. But sympathetic joy, that's a, you know, mudita, delighting in the joy of others. And here I feel like we've created such an amazing sangha. And I just feel like there's a lot of joy that we have for each other, just that we're practicing together. You know, I know I have a lot of mudita for you guys. You don't have to feel the same, but. And then the other one comes back to, like, wise intention is renunciation. So that's another joy on the path, is this renunciation again. So like I said, the bliss of blamelessness, the precepts that we took at the beginning, not causing harm to other living beings. It feels so good. You know, how am I contributing to the wellness of this planet, the wellness of those around me? There's beauty in that. There's joy in that. Joseph Goldstein also, you know, and I don't know if it's his own words, but when he talks about renunciation, again, it's not being addicted in the mind, not feeling trapped or caught. You know, so here in this retreat setting, we're so lucky. You know, at first, like I said, it can feel like deprivation. You know, they're taking my phone. But it's, you know, like, how simple is life right now? When I'm on retreat, whether teaching or sitting, I get home and I look at all my stuff. And then stuff creates chores. And then chores creates, you know, time. And then time is like, oh, well, there's nothing left for what I really want to be doing. So renunciation, really consider, you know, how lucky we are right now that we get to renounce, that we don't have all the
choices of grocery stores and lattes and restaurants. And, you know, I mean, all those things that seem so like we feel so like, oh, America, yay. We, you know, we have choice. And and really, like, sometimes it's just a burden. Sometimes it's just not that fun. Anyway, so, and then the joy of generosity. It's another big one. And when I think of the precepts, for me, like I said, I like to reframe them from what I can't do to what I'm giving back. How I'm supporting others' practice, how I'm supporting others from this, like, we're giving others fearlessness and we're saving ourselves from regret. You know, when we decide to not cause harm and to be generous to another, we're really feeding ourselves. You know, you'll hear that thing like when people say, will you please let me give to you? Because it feels good to me to give to you. When we don't let people give to us, we're taking something from them. And then the last one I'll talk about, because there's a few more, but I'm getting tired of talking. And we didn't really get into this too much. We didn't talk about vedna, feeling tones, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral so much. We alluded to it a little bit in instructions. But again, it's like when you're noticing pleasant, and there are wholesome pleasants. I know we talked a lot about sort of the craving, you know, the gruesome, the pleasants that are, you know, that cause us suffering. But there's also a lot of pleasants that don't. There's a lot of really wholesome pleasants, skillful pleasants. And I talked about them sort of in the first joy of, you know, the spiritual path. So let yourself enjoy something. Like if you're really liking the taste of something, wow, it's so good. You know, and then watch when you slip over into greed. And then we get to be on the path again and watching right view. You know, it's just like it's all okay. If we could just spend the next couple days knowing the Eightfold Path, knowing the Four Brahmaviharas, letting them see when they're there, when they change, when you're being more mindful or when you're having like a deep insight or when you're opening the door for somebody and they're bowing to you. I mean, those little things that we get to feel here, I love it when someone bows to me, you know, when I don't mean like to me, but like, I love that little interaction that happens. You know, I've moved out of the way or someone so nice took my dishes the other day. You know, it's so generous. Washed my dish. So really notice, like, it's okay to have these pleasant feelings arise. It's really okay. Enjoy them. Appreciate them. We are on this path so that we can see those, that we can clear the dust from our eyes, right? Clear the dust from our eyes so we can see these teachings, live these teachings, move, be these teachings. Enjoy what's pleasant. It's totally okay. Notice when you're clinging. And if it leads you to suffering, if it doesn't, fine. You might be deluded, but fine. So I'll just close with a quote from Aristotle. Bring a little of him in. Just very simple. We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit. So let's just see what we're feeding. What are we feeding? Which wolf are we feeding? And really let yourself feel the joy. Let yourself feel the pleasure when you come back to presence, when you come back to being awake. Instead of the reclamation of why'd you go there, judgment, like give yourself a pat on the back. Say you did good. You came back. Beautiful. Enjoy. So let's just sit for a second.